Welcome to Energy Insights. In today's episode, we speak with Dr. Roxy Matthew-Cole. Roxy is a climate scientist at the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology. He's made breakthrough contributions to observing and predicting the Indo-Pacific climate that relates to food, water, and economic security in the region. Roxy is also a lead author on the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change Reports and former chair of the Indian Ocean Region Panel. He currently leads research on climate change and its impacts on monsoons, cyclones, heatwaves, and marine ecosystems, and works with citizen science networks, local governments, and media to bring science to the masses. We spoke about many topics, including how Roxy got into climate science, the science behind heatwaves and their impacts, and how they form, the implications of El Niño, marine heatwaves, monsoons, extreme cyclones, and other topics. It was an education speaking with Roxy, and I hope you enjoy the show. Okay, we're here with Roxy Matthew-Cole. Roxy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Ashley. It's a pleasure to be here.
So now, there's a lot of ground to cover in this episode because there's so much I'd like to pick your brain on, but I will try keep things as succinct as possible. But I think a good place to start would be, would you be able to give us a brief background on who you are, what kind of work you do, and what you're working on lately?
Right. I'm a climate scientist at the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology in Pune. So this institution is under the Ministry of Earth Sciences in India. And as a climate scientist, I work on extreme weather events, how they develop, how they are intensifying in the recent climate change and so on for the larger tropical region, particularly the Indo-Pacific, which is kind of heavily populated, densely populated with low adaptive capacity. And that has been my focus for quite a long time. I have been working on this for almost two decades on the rapid pace of climate change and extreme weather events over the Indo-Pacific, because it connects to the food, water, and energy requirements and security for roughly one-third to one-half of the global population.
Yeah, it's definitely an important area, and I share your concerns about the region. I mean, how did you get to working on climate science in general? I mean, was this a gradual process, or was there a sudden event that kind of switched you onto it? I mean, it's such a complex system, and you know, we're still in the process of comprehending it. I'm just wondering what initially kind of drew you into it.
I grew up reading a lot of books, yeah, and somehow they got me interested in natural sciences. So I was, when I grew up, I wanted to be a naturalist. So I used to read books by Gerald Durrell, who used to write about animals. One of his famous books is My Family and Other Animals. So that's how I grew up. And then at some point, I started getting interested in physics. My mom was a physics teacher as well. And I used to read books by Stephen Hawking, Carl Sagan, and so on. And later I wanted to be an astrophysicist. But then at that point of time, this was like two, 3 decades ago. And at that time, the higher education opportunities in India, particularly for astrophysics, was not that great. Yeah. And the next closer one was oceanography. So I saw that there is a master's course in oceanography in my state, in Kerala, in south of India. And so immediately after my bachelor's in physics, I joined for ocean physics, learning ocean physics. And I understood that we might have tried to understand a lot about space, but the oceans are still unknown. There is a lot to be known about the ocean, the deep ocean surrounding us, which on which we depend for our life, food, everything, right? So that's how I started my journey around in the start of 2000, year 2000. And then I moved on to PhD, doing PhD in Japan in Hokkaido University, where I explored the role of these oceans on guiding or, you know, governing the monsoon. The monsoon are the changing winds that bring rains. So for the larger Indian Ocean region, we can say it's the African Australasian monsoon, which it's one large system of huge winds blowing from the south of Indian Ocean, touching the African continent, then moving to South Asia, then East Asia, and also touching parts of Australia, Northern Australia as well. So I studied how the oceans, how the variability and changes in the ocean has a large role in how the monsoons evolve over time. So that was an eye-opener for me. I found that the oceans have a larger role than we thought before. But at that time, while I was doing PhD, climate change was not, at least in my research area, it was not a frequent topic of discussion. But by the time I finished my PhD, it started popping up here and there, and we found that it's touching every part of the monsoon, every part of the ocean in different ways. And gradually I moved on to understanding how the ocean is changing due to climate change and emissions, how the monsoons are changing due to emissions and global warming. Yeah, so it was a gradual, understanding of how climate affected us on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, what you said about the oceans, about, you know, we know so much about space, but we're so, you know, we're not clueless about the oceans, but we definitely could know more. I mean, I had a marine biologist on the show earlier, Katharina Fabricius, who was talking about, you know, a very similar thing. She was like, you know, we still have a lot to learn about how this entire system interacts
definitely
with the planet.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, like, sticking with, you know, a bit of history and as well, and now you've said you've been a climate scientist for decades now, and you've also been an author in the IPCC reports, which are also recognized as, you know, the gold standard of laying out data on what's happening with climate change and the potential impacts. So I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, what's it been like working from a scientist perspective over the years? You know, what have been the ups and downs
right,
that you've kind of gone through, the motions, so to speak?
Right. Well, there has been a lot of ups and downs. So, in some ways, it's all ups. In some ways, it's all downs, I would say. So if I look at the numbers in terms of climate change and so on, I came to realize, even though I gradually put my foot into climate change, understanding climate change and all, later on, I understood, okay, on a daily basis, I am looking into these numbers of climate change, whether I look at rains, whether I look at temperature, whether I look at humidity, tropical cyclones or hurricanes, or heat waves, storm surges, sea level, all these numbers are going up. Yeah, the charts are all going up, getting redder, more and more red. We started defining new color scales so that we can show the changes in all these variables or parameters much more strikingly, because they are going off the charts, right? And so at first, like a few decades, a few years back, until a few years back, I used to see these numbers more clinically, Yeah. I didn't get emotional about them because it was more of a technical approach that I tried to do with it. And I kept on publishing new research, new understanding about how cyclones evolve, how they are intensifying, how heat waves are increasing more, how the monsoon patterns are changing, how extreme rains and floods are happening, how droughts are increasing. So all these extreme events, yeah? So I see them in charts, and I try to keep a distance with them as a scientist, not to get involved in it emotionally, and not to get involved in the policy side as well. But later I understood, I started seeing the impacts. Well, the public also started seeing the impacts of these changes in the last one decade. And I saw several reports from nearby regions of people dying. Yeah, and these are, take any year in the recent period, we have people dying due to different extreme events. And almost on a daily basis, I get media requests. It's for a newspaper from the northern part of India, northeastern part of India, South India, or Central or West India, or it can be a TV or international, because on a daily basis, there is one extreme weather event or another happening in some part of the country. Yeah, it's India is like more than 20 degrees in latitude, north and south, and same west to east as well. So it's huge. It's a huge country and densely populated. The highest population currently with 1.4 billion people, right? And so I used to get this information from nearby and you know, otherwise far off states as well, that people are dying. What caused these extreme events? How can we save them? So I understood that the country, the public are aware that, okay, climate change is there, extreme weather events are happening. But now what do we do about it? They wanted solutions as well. Yeah. And recently, for example, in 2018-19, my hometown from where I originally am, from Kerala, it saw record-breaking floods in 2018 and then in 19 as well, and partial floods in 2020. Now it is going through a drought. So this affected my parents as well, because their house is on slightly elevated region, but surrounding areas are low-lying areas. So they were like trapped in the house for like 2-3 days or more. But there were other people who lost their lives during those floods, those phenomenon floods. Yeah. And in this year, in the current year, there were heat waves in the state where I'm working, Maharashtra, close to Mumbai, around 14, 15 people died on a single day due to heat waves. And this was not a record-breaking heat waves. It was a normal heat. The temperatures were around between 35 to 38 degrees Celsius. It was not too hot for India. But at the same time, the humidity was high as well. And not only that, these people were outside in the open ground for a ceremony, and they were exposed to this hot, humid weather for a long duration. Yeah. And then I ended up writing an article about this event. And I contacted the district collector of this region for the details of the disease so that I get to know more details about them. And then I got the details with their names, their age, and address and phone numbers and all those details of these 14, 15 people. And then I understood, then I saw this name, so people. It struck me, okay, these are people like me. Just, I mean, they were my neighbors in some way. And out of 14, about 10, if I remember right, 10 or 12 were women. They were women of about between 45 to 60 years old, which means they were mostly mothers as well. And they left their homes early morning and they came to the ceremony in the open grounds, which was a political function. And by afternoon, they lost their lives. They were dead. So seeing this, I mean, feeling in my heart that these were living people until a few hours or a few days back, and I am right now writing about them, and they were impacted by, you know, I mean, partially climate change, but partially due to our inability to take care of them, take care of these situations, yeah, or manage these situations affected me that this could have been something avoidable, yeah. So these kind of events have been happening in the recent past, and those are my. So while the charts are going up, these are the down times that I have, which are affecting me in different ways. Yeah. So as much as I want, as much as I try to be technical about the numbers, the charts, clinical about it, but still they affect me in multiple ways, directly as well and indirectly as well.
Yeah, no, I share your view when something becomes, you know, personal. I mean, this happened to me last year in, you know, in Australia when the northern part of New South Wales got these crazy floods, you know, like the, you know, some of the biggest rainfall, you know, downpours on record. And the area where I grew up, it's like in this, the forested valley,
What's that place called?
It's near the northern rivers, like around kind of south of the Gold Coast.
South of the Gold Coast. Yeah.
So I grew up in like a forested region in there, and you know, the stream, there's a little stream, like a creek, you know, nothing big, you know, when I was growing up. I remember this, you know, this stream very clearly. And you know, and then these rains happened. Someone else was living in the house at the time, so I wasn't living there, but we're still in contact with them, and they sent us pictures after these floods. And I just remember the whole valley had transformed into just this unrecognizable, you know, place. I mean, it was unbelievable. And when something like that happens to you, it really, it kind of hits home, and you're like, geez, this is really real. I mean, this is happening now. It's unescapable in a sense.
Yeah, it's at your doorstep, right?
Yeah,
literally
yeah.
At your doorstep. Yeah, I see that. Yeah,
and I think this is a good place to. I mean, you were mentioning the heat. Pretty regular heat in India. I mean, 38 degrees is nothing.
Yeah,
nothing new for India. I mean, I've also been in India when it gets up to that point. But I think when the humidity, you know, when you add on that extra factor, it becomes a deadly thing. And
yeah, because. I remember last year, this year we didn't have record-breaking heat, but last year we had record-breaking heat in the Indo-Pakistan region. The temperatures going up to 50 degrees Celsius in India, close to Delhi as well. Delhi reported 49.5 to 50 degrees Celsius last year, and Pakistan 51 degrees Celsius. And to think about that region, particularly in Pakistan, when the temperatures are going high, you might have read heard about this book Ministry of Future, where they talk about you know, heat waves in the future, but this is like happening right now in this region, right? And to think about that these people, even if they want to escape the heat, many of them would have air conditioners or even fans. But even if they have air conditioner or fan or some kind of cooler, they don't have electricity to use that. Yeah, during those period, because there were long electricity cuts. Many parts are not even connected by electricity, particularly in Pakistan and northwest, some parts, pockets of India as well. So it's these impacts, even if you are aware of the impacts, it's quite difficult to survive it. Yeah.
With these heat waves, I mean, have these always, in a sense, been a certainty, or are they occurring at, I guess, a rate harder and faster than some climate models predicted in the past?
Well, it seems so. So one thing is, we many times overlook what the projections are saying or forecasts are saying, because even now we know that, so right now all these extreme weather events that are happening are in response to that 1 degree Celsius in global temperature change. Right, 1.1 we have reached, and it's going beyond. And we know for certain, because global nations haven't reduced, and they continue to emit more and more carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. We know between 2020 and 2040, but that's a living decade, so it will reach 1.5. And between 2040 and 2060, that's in the nearby decades, we will reach 2 degrees Celsius, doubling of the global temperature change. And we know for certain that many of these extreme weather events are going to intensify. Yeah. But we always think, okay, these numbers are quite huge. They are going to happen somewhere in the future. They may not affect me or my survival, my family, so on. Even though somewhere we know that, okay, it's growing around us at a fast pace. So I think this, the same notion corresponds to what we are seeing right now as well. So when I go through the IPCC reports, I see that, okay, I am currently a part of the preparation of IPCC reports. But my predecessors, my former IPCC colleagues had prepared earlier IPCC reports, which said that in the near term, these extreme weather events are going to intensify, become larger. But their near time is where I am living currently. Yeah, you get the point. And so many of these, though they spike in terms of magnitude and their enormity, strike huge for us and we are taken by surprise. If you look at what the projections said or are saying, these shouldn't be surprises, yeah? So we are expecting this kind of response from the climate system, from the atmosphere, from the ocean. Yeah. So the kind of floods, heat waves and all which are happening are totally tied up with what the climate projections have been saying for quite long.
For scientists, it may be, you know, for example, like as you just mentioned, like it has been something that has been well known about. And if you have been following things, you shouldn't be surprised at what's happening, right? But I think a lot of people are being surprised, especially this year in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, All over the Northern Hemisphere, we've seen a lot of crazy, crazy things happening. And I think one of the reasons for this is because heat waves are now really hitting countries that previously were quite temperate. I mean, Europe is a great example of that. I mean, if we, for example, like as we mentioned earlier, like 38 degrees for India is not really a big deal, but in a place like Europe, it's considered, you know, unfathomable in many ways.
Right.
But I guess do you see the events of this year in particular and the places that heat waves are now hitting, is it kind of, do you think that that's, I guess, kind of growing with this sense of urgency in with heat waves now? Do you think that that's playing a part?
Well, I guess so. And I think, this has brought in a lot of attention as well, that the fact that these heat waves are occurring in Europe, in the U.S., in the Northern Hemisphere in a large scale than what the general public was expecting to happen. taking it to, you know, the like my wife is currently in Switzerland, and she went there thinking that, okay, it will be cool, cooler than usual, but she was exposed to kind of hot days. They couldn't go out in, you know, around the daytime. So they were like waiting for the evenings, afternoons, and late afternoons and evenings to go out. And yeah, so this is something, for example, recently we saw Canada temperatures, I think it was last year or the year before, going above 50 degrees Celsius. Yeah. So all these are happening kind of, but it's like a jolt for the entire globe, I would say, to see that we all are in this together. Yeah. Whether it's farther south in India or more south in your place in Australia, everywhere we are seeing some kind of event or other. Yeah, and manifested in a huge, large way. The floods in Germany, the bushfires in Australia are becoming stronger and stronger. And this year is, the current year is much more particular because it's an El Nino year. Yeah, so until the last 2-3 years, it was a La Nina, which means generally on a natural cycle, you have this cool and warm oscillations in the Pacific of the La Nina and the El Nino. And so the La Nina kind of bit suppressed the global temperatures, I would say. But the El Nino is happening right now, and it's at a moderate level. The temperatures in the Pacific are high, and that is a way of the ocean to vent out whatever heat it had been absorbing from the global warming, yeah, for quite a long time. In fact, the oceans absorb more than 93%. Earlier, we thought it was 90%. The most recent estimates show that it's 93% of the additional heat from global warming is absorbed by the oceans. Otherwise, the atmosphere would have been so hot. So the oceans are kind of saving us, but there is a limit. And there are episodes like when we have El Nino or marine heat waves, when this heat from the oceans blow out suddenly in a short period to the atmosphere and change the global weather patterns everywhere. Yeah, because all the weather climate system is connected. Even if it's happening in the Pacific is like 1/3 of the global ocean, and it's connected with the atmospheric circulation. So it affects Australia, it affects India, it affects the US, Europe, everywhere. Yeah. And we see the impacts of global warming and climate change much more pronounced during El Nino years, like the current year. So surely, at least for a short time, we might see global average temperatures going beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius this year or the next year during this El Nino period. That's what scientists are expecting. Yeah. And the extreme weather events might also follow. For currently, we see that generally when we have an El Nino in the Pacific, it affects the trade winds across the tropics, and the monsoon winds we are having over the South Asian or even touching Australia. These are actually trade winds which are meandering towards the land. And these winds get weakened during El Nino, particularly for the South Asian region, and result in deficits of rainfall and droughts. So right now, the Indian monsoon rainfall is at a 7% deficit, and some regions like the agriculture belt in north are currently under 20 to 30% deficit or more. And my home state, Kerala, is running at a 45% deficit. Yeah. My district, which is called Kottayam, where my parents live, is running at a deficit of 50 to 60%. That's for the, yeah. Yeah, this is all these regions depend on the monsoon rainfall for agriculture. So there are cash crops and other crops as well. In fact, recently my uncle was calling. He is in the nearby district. He has farms in cardamom farms in the nearby district. Yeah, which totally depend on the amount of water available during the monsoon. And he was worried because their water levels were going down. And he wanted to know what the forecasts are. And the forecasts are not rosy for the next few weeks as well. They are showing more deficits to come. So it's so you see that a few years back, we had floods in Kerala. But before that, we had droughts as well. So droughts, floods, droughts. So this is a kind of changing pattern of monsoons that we are seeing. And this is happening within a monsoon season as well, because, and this is a property of global warming, because warm air holds more moisture and for a longer time. So it doesn't rain for a long time, but when it rains, all that moisture that gets accumulated in the atmosphere gets dumped in a short spell of time. So maybe for a few weeks in a season, it doesn't rain. And all that rain of a month's rain or a season's rain comes down in a few hours to a few days' time. Yeah, and that causes both deficits and at the same time, flash floods as well. So many of these regions, like the Western Ghats of India or North and West, the Himalayas, you see a lot of landslides happening. People are losing their homes, homes and lives and livelihoods as well. Their agriculture is also lost. They can't go back because of these torrential rains and landslides, mudslides, which are happening in a short spell of time. They do not have any way to respond to these kind of events. And this is happening for the entire Indo-Pacific Sea, whether it's Indonesia or China and parts of Pakistan, Bangladesh. Bangladesh is also affected by sea level rise and so on. So it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's no country is really spared. Right. It's something that is really affecting everybody, no matter where you live. And, you know, obviously the effects vary, but I think in a sense you can certainly see things are happening in the negative sense, where the normal system is disrupted. Because I mean, as you mentioned, like, even though the monsoon is at only a 7%, doesn't sound like much, right? But it accounts for quite a lot, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Well, that 7% is for the deficit for the whole India average, so it doesn't actually make any sense to hang on to those numbers, because India is huge and it's kind of widespread. So some regions receive more rainfall, some regions receive so less rainfall. Like I said, some states are running at huge deficits. So this gets quite, the impacts get quite accentuated. It's not uniform, right? Yeah.
I mean, I guess that it explains, I mean, for example, in India, they recently stopped exporting wheat. Or was it wheat or rice?
This happened with the heat wave last year. The wheat, that was a temporary, stopping of wheat exports, because the heat waves, the last year, the heat waves like, Not even a few weeks or months. It was a season-long heat wave. It started somewhere in February, March, went to April, May, to early June. And even the agriculture was affected, the food grains were up to 20%. This is from the reports that I read. Food grains, the wheat grains, were up to 10 to 20% smaller than normal. Yeah, so directly it affected the food production, the wheat production. And I think that's when India made a precautionary ban of exports, wheat exports that time. But I think after that it got revived. But this is the kind of situation that we are looking into. Yeah.
I just wanted to dig into the science a little bit about heat waves in particular. I mean, how do they form in general? I mean, if there is an easy way to explain it, I know that these things can get quite complex, but if there is an easy way to explain it, right. I'd love to hear it. And right. I mean, we're hearing more about this phrase like heat domes, for example. I mean, this is going around a while. I was just wondering if you could, I guess, give us a little tour about how heat waves are formed and what heat domes are.
Right, right. So heat dome generally, I mean, I will start with the most simplistic explanation. So heat dome is generally when, a column of air, like for example, let's imagine where we stand, if that column of air is not moving, yeah? So if that column of air is not moving and, you know, generally if there is, the sun is still shining, the heat gets trapped. I mean, because that air traps more and more, keeps on trapping or absorbing that heat more and more, yeah? And it will get heated up. So because it's not moving, it's standstill, we call it a heat dome. But if you extend that explanation, it happens because there are some regions where there is sinking or subsidence of air from the top of the atmospheric troposphere, which is like 10 to 18 kilometers, depending on where you are. And so this air sinks in high pressure regions. So there is air sinking from top, which is generally dry air sinking. And when it sinks, it also compresses the air below. So when this compression happens, that air gets heated close to the ground again. Yeah. And when it is, so in those regions where the sinking happens, it is drier and it's getting heated up. At the same time, the clouds are less because it is dry and hot. The clouds are less in those regions. So it allows or exposes that region to more sunlight or solar energy. So that additional energy gets trapped in those heat domes. Now, due to climate change, there's more heat getting trapped because there is more carbon dioxide in the air. Yeah. And so this kind of this has been intensifying in the recent period. Now, if you look at a large scale, we know that particularly in the tropical regions and tropical oceans and all, the oceans are getting heated up, and which means that there is more evaporation happening in these regions. So warm moisture is rising from these regions of convection. Yeah. So when there is warm moisture rising in some place, in another place, this has to be compensated. So there is an outflow in the top of the atmosphere. And this compensates us. So when this warm moisture rises in those convective regions, as it reaches the top, it expands. It expands and spread around. When it spread around, that moisture is lost, it becomes drier. And then it starts sinking in other regions. Yeah, that is kind of the atmospheric circulation. So it is this sinking air that I was talking about earlier. Yeah. So this sinking air is drier. So more and more sinking air happens as more and more evaporation happens in the other region. Yeah. So these kind of heat domes are intensifying. Heat domes used to be there earlier also happened, but now they are much more frequent, long lasting. And sometimes they interact with the jet streams in the northern hemisphere, yeah, and we see that sometimes. So jet streams are like huge waves in the northern hemisphere, the northern latitudes, that transport the heat and moisture and other things around the globe. But there are times when they get wider, and when they get wider, they get slower as well. So the heat transported gets slower. And sometimes they move very slow. They are very sluggish. And that accentuates or kind of intensifies these heat domes. So when they encounter these heat domes that I was talking about, the heat intensifies and stay longer. And it's like, so regions like Northern Europe, Canada, US, see phenomenal surge in temperatures for several days, and fires as well. Yeah, because it's dry. Yeah.
So it's like everything is, in a sense, when those jet streams widen, everything kind of moves in slow motion. Whereas if they were functioning properly, it would basically wash the heat out into the, exactly, into the global system, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any suggestion there that climate change is having an effect on that jet stream in that widening and or thinning?
It's not clear to me. Maybe there, I think there's a lot of research on jet stream variability and so on. At least there are studies saying that the fluctuations in the jet stream are much more than earlier. Yeah. And so I'm not sure, but I've seen studies saying that even airplane travel can be affected because airplanes travel at the top of the troposphere around between 10-12 kilometers from the ground. And this is where generally they are not affected by the weather and moisture down below in the troposphere. But at that level where the airplanes fly, they encounter the, you know, upper level jets. And if there are more fluctuations and which are less predictable for the jet stream, it can make, airplane travel much more scarier. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I have read studies like that.
I mean, if we just are sticking on heat domes for a minute and just heat waves in general, I think that, I mean, I feel like urban cities, mm-hmm, or urban, right, areas as well, you've got this thing called the urban heat island effect too. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, the majority of the world's cities are expanding. So that means there's more concrete, there's more asphalt, you know. So all of these things are absorbing heat. And that is, in a sense, exacerbating an already pretty bad situation when a heat wave comes across the city. I mean, how much do you think that modern city design kind of fails when heat waves come into the picture? I mean, what are we doing wrong?
Yeah. To give you an example on how severe that is, the Arbor Heat Island, I'll just give you the numbers which I saw from satellite images of Delhi during the heat wave last year. Yeah. And these are nighttime temperatures, which gives a clear idea on what urban heat island is. So a one-day picture, snapshot of one night of Delhi, the urban Delhi and the nearby rural areas. The difference in temperature, nighttime temperatures, was between 15 to 20 degrees Celsius. 20
wow.
degrees Celsius, the difference in nighttime temperatures. And this is happening in many urban regions across the globe, particularly in tropical countries where the building guidelines are not not followed or not optimal for, you know, keeping the temperatures cool. So what happens is that generally, if you we get the sun's energy during the daytime as shortwave energy, and during the nighttime, the land cools by emitting that energy as long wave. So that's how the land cools at nighttime. So if you have open space or more trees with canopy and all, there are multiple ways in which that long wave radiation or the heat escapes from the ground. Yeah, Even the trees try to give way for the heat to be absorbed and then re-radiated back to the atmosphere, so the land cools very fast. So this also means that open spaces and natural spaces, wetlands, are quite important for save us from heat. But instead of that, if you are having one building close to another, and these are like skyscrapers like Delhi or Mumbai or New York or maybe Melbourne as well, where you are staying. So if you have packed concrete and asphalt and roads and construction, then these concrete do not allow that heat to escape during nighttime. Yeah. Long wave energy, that radiation doesn't happen. It gets trapped, and that kind of, blows up as the urban heat island, like shooting up to 50, 20 degrees Celsius. I can't even imagine. I was shocked to see those satellite images of temperatures.
Yeah, that is a massive difference. I mean, that in a sense as well is a difference, potentially between life and death for somebody in the case of where if somebody's living in a very small apartment that's not at all geared for dealing with heat. If you don't have air conditioning, I mean, that it's like a furnace basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I could go on and talk to you about heat waves for a long time, but I don't want to neglect your other areas of expertise and areas of interest, and namely marine environments and monsoons and cyclones. And we've of course talked about some of these already, but
right.
I did want to shift into a bit of the marine side of things. Now, like as you mentioned before, the ocean is responsible for the vast majority of heat absorption. So if we didn't have the oceans, I mean, our global temperature would be completely off the charts right now. We would not be living in such a temperate environment, so to speak. But
right.
In that sense, things aren't looking too great for the oceans now either, because for many years now, and land-based heat waves are just starting to get mainstream attention, but for many years now the oceans have been actually breaking heat records almost on a yearly basis basically. And we can see this with events like coral bleaching is kind of a typical example of the oceans telling us that things are getting too warm. I mean, in your view, do you think that marine heat waves are just as impactful as land-based ones?
So the term marine heat waves were coined around 2010, 2011, when the record-breaking extreme ocean temperatures were observed off the coast of Australia, the west coast of Australia, connected with the Loewen Current and all. And we understood these are exceptional temperatures in the ocean, and they have an impact on the marine ecosystem as well. Since then, the science of marine heat waves has been expanding, and we are trying to understand. It's still emerging, the processes, the impacts, multifaceted impacts, and so on. But anyway, right now, we don't always call heat waves over land as heat waves anymore. We call them terrestrial heat waves, because we have heat waves in the ocean as well. So we want to distinguish between them, right? So particularly for scientists like me and all, who deal with both land changes and ocean changes as well, I try to distinguish as terrestrial heat waves. And we have reached that stage, yeah. For this year, the global ocean temperatures are currently at an all-time high relative to temperatures since the start of instrumental record. And right now, about 30% of global ocean, this is in August, 27 to 30% of the global ocean is experiencing a marine heat wave. And this is kind of a bit stimulated by the El Nino riding over a global warming signal. Yeah. So that is quite huge, has huge implications on marine ecosystems like corals. Corals occupy only 0.1% of the globe's surface, 0.1%. But more than 45% of the marine biodiversity depends on corals or the coral reef systems. Yeah. So any damage to these coral reef systems will be impacting the life's pyramid. We call them food pyramids. Sometimes I think that food thing is based on the human perspective. Okay, everything is food for us. We are on top. Yeah. So life pyramid, I will call better. And it's affecting that life pyramid, life chain from top to bottom. Yeah. And if you think about corals have this mucous membrane around them. We call them zooxanthellae. This mucous membrane, thin membrane, is what gives them the color, the beautiful colors of corals, and protects them from high temperatures as well. But when very high temperatures, which goes beyond their tolerance level, like beyond 28 degrees Celsius and so on, or 30 degrees Celsius happens, the mucous membrane gets peeled off, what we call as bleaching. Then the corals look white. Yeah. Usually corals have a mechanism to, you know, if the entire mucous membrane is not lost, they revive, they regenerate. But if there is more and more bleaching happening because of multiple marine heat waves, extreme ocean temperatures happening, then the corals die, what we call as coral mortality. So mass coral mortality, particularly in the, you know, the Great Barrier Reefs and so on, is happening very frequently and in a large scale. And this is of huge concern. And not just through corals. Fishes are dying sometimes because of fishes and fishery industries. Well, when we talk from a very human perspective, occasionally we see, for example, it happened in the Atlantic, the U.S. fisheries had temporary collapse a few years back because of huge heat waves in the North Pacific. And similarly, off the Korean Peninsula, they saw that, okay, both terrestrial and marine heat waves are co-occurring near the ocean. They are like feeding back to each other. And this led to mass mortality of fishes, both in the ocean and also the aquaculture as well. Yeah. And also there were heat waves over the land, which affected the humans directly. So these kind of events are happening around now it has caught the attention of the climate scientists working on climate change. Recently, I am part of this, we started to put together a team of international scientists working on marine heat waves from around the globe. These are scientists working on the Pacific, heat waves in the Pacific, heat waves in the Atlantic, in the Indian Ocean region, the Mediterranean and other regional seas and so on. And we had a training workshop so that we train the early career researchers and young scientists and so on, students and so on, so that they understand marine heat waves, learn the technology to, you know, detect and identify and model or simulate these marine heat waves and their impacts so that we understand them better and forecast them as well. Yeah. So we had that summer school July in Italy, close to the Mediterranean. And at that time, when we were having the summer school, marine heat waves were happening in the Mediterranean Sea, exceptional record-breaking temperatures in the Mediterranean, potentially affecting the both the climate system and also the marine ecosystem there. Yeah. So the impacts are still being unveiled. We are still understanding. As of now, from my own research, we understand the marine heat waves impact tropical cyclones, resulting in rapid intensification of tropical cyclones. We can get more into that later.
Yeah. I mean, just on that note, I just plant a flag there. I mean, in terms of tropical cyclones, I mean, cyclones get fueled off warmer waters.
And exactly.
I was going to ask, I mean, there was one cyclone in the Indian Ocean this year that is, I think was particular of interest. I think Cyclone Mocha.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just wondering what made that in particularly different compared to other, you know, cyclones that have hit the region. I mean, was there anything kind of a bit unique about it?
So I would club Mocha with a few other recent cyclones which happened in the Bay of Bengal in the Indian Ocean, like Cyclone Amphan, Cyclone Fani. These were all extremely severe cyclones happened in the very recent period. And all of them displayed these characteristics of rapid intensification. So now, what is rapid intensification? Technically, if a cyclone or a hurricane intensifies by its core wind speed intensifies by 55 kilometers per hour in less than 24 hours, yeah, that is called rapid intensification. For example, right now, if a cyclone is 100 kilometers, the wind speed inside the cyclone is like 100 kilometers per hour, and if it intensifies to 155 kilometers per hour, that's called rapid intensification, if that happens in a short time. And that's actually a matter of life and death because, for example, on the coast of India or Bangladesh or Myanmar where Cyclone Mocha hit, you see a cyclone on the sea, which is a weak cyclone or a moderate cyclone with moderate winds. And you're going to sleep thinking it's a weak cyclone, weak to moderate cyclone. And when you wake up, it had already intensified into an extremely severe cyclone of from 100 kilometer per hour to 200 kilometer per hour speed cyclone. Now, this happened with Cyclone Amphan, Cyclone Mocha, Cyclone Fani, many cyclones in the very recent period, the last 5 years. And you wake up and see that your roof is already gone, because we were not prepared for that kind of intense cyclone. And this is what happened with Mocha too. One particular thing about Mocha was that it stayed there for in the sea for a kind of long duration, and it kind of fooled many of the forecasters because initially the forecasts were showing in the direction towards Bangladesh or the east coast of India, then moving towards Myanmar side. So the track of cyclones sometimes, particularly long duration cyclones, can be tricky. And why are they living for a long duration? Because there is more heat in the ocean. So cyclones derive their source of energy from the warm waters of the warm tropical waters, because this gives a consistent supply of heat and moisture, which is a source of energy. Yeah, so which is why they are called tropical cyclones as well. They form over the tropical waters where the temperatures are generally about 28 degrees Celsius. Yeah, that is kind of precondition for cyclones to form. Now, there is more heat, so consistent supply of heat, and this cyclone duration gets extended than earlier, and they intensify to large, humongous, strong cyclones. By the time they hit land, it is extremely severe, and the destruction is huge. Now, cyclone forecasts have improved in the recent period, drastically, I would say, because 25 years back when I was in college, I remember there was a cyclone on the east coast of India called the Odisha cyclone. This was in 1999, which claimed the lives of tens of thousands of people. So the fatalities, number of fatalities were in five-digit numbers. Right now, because of forecast, which kind of pinpoints the landfall area and the time it arrives, the cyclone arrives, we are able to evacuate people. So the number of people dying has gone down to two-digit numbers, which is a sign of the progress in forecasting. But at the same time, so what are we doing with this forecast? We are evacuating people, but they have no place to come back because still the infrastructure, the agriculture, everything is lost. And sometimes you see these cyclones, storm surges and sea level rise, everything together, pushing a lot of salt water into the land, tens of kilometers of salt water into agricultural land. And this is salt water, not fresh water, which damages the agriculture for years to come. So livelihoods are lost still, yeah. Properties are lost. Homes are lost. So the impact of cyclones like Moka are quite huge. And there's one thing particular about Moka, which is more than from a climate change point of view, it's more about the local or the regional policies and governments. So Myanmar is under military rule, and though India provides its forecasting, and India also has joint exercises in terms of disaster management with Myanmar, which is like India is playing a huge role in terms of providing these services to South Asian countries. But still, there were unverified reports of a lot of people dying in Myanmar because of there are a lot of Rohingya refugees and so on. So this cyclone Moka hit a place close to where the Rohingya colonies are, the refugees there. And we don't know the number of deaths. We don't know how they have survived still. So the extent of the impacts are not well known for this kind of cyclone. But I can say from last 20 to 30 years, even though cyclone forecasting has improved, only 6% of global tropical cyclones occur in the Indian Ocean region. Out of this, only 4% happens in the Bay of Bengal. But 80% of the deaths, global deaths due to cyclones, are from this North Indian Ocean region surrounding Bay of Bengal. Yeah. Which is,
I mean, that comes down to a lot of the concentration of populations and the big cities on the coasts as well, I believe.
Yeah, concentration of the population in low-lying areas with low adaptive capacity. Yeah.
So, Roxy, being mindful of your time, I know we're almost coming up to the end of it. I just had one last question that I wanted to get your thoughts on. I mean, we've got COP28 coming up at the end of the year. And I just wanted to know, like, you as a climate scientist, what would be your message to the public and also to the, you know, even on people working on climate policy at COP28? I mean, because everything that we've talked about, from heat waves to monsoon to marine life to cyclones, I mean, this is all really, really important things, and a lot is on the line. I mean, what would be your, I guess, parting message?
Right. So we have for a long time, we have said that, the global temperatures are icing. All the parties in the COP know that climate change is happening, and we have pinpointed why it is happening. And we have clearly mentioned in several IPCC reports, one report after another, global reports, national reports, and so on, that mitigation, urgent mitigation, significant mitigation or reduction of carbon dioxide emissions are quite crucial to save our planet and save our lives, livelihoods, and all for our survival and for the survival of the animals and the plants and the trees and all the creatures that we have seen so far they are dying, and this is quite important. We keep on saying that, but parties haven't agreed upon, or there is no binding agreement in terms of reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, that we feel that at least from my experience, there are communities and nations and states that are trying hard to fight against climate change and work on local adaptation. Yeah. So, for example, I work with communities which are severely hit by floods and droughts and heat waves and all. And these communities want to do something, but they are helpless. They cannot wait for the globe to act. Yeah. They cannot wait because, their roofs are gone, or their houses are flooded, or their families hit by heat strokes due to heat waves. And they cannot wait for some, all the nations, all the parties to agree upon. So one thing I would look forward to is, and what these communities want, yeah, of course, mitigation is on the top, but exchange of technology, which is part of one of the, COP discussions, which can help in not only reduce carbon emissions or carbon footprint locally, but also help in adaptation. Yeah. So I think that is quite important. We also talk about climate justice and so on, but I think this is one way of making it sustainable, exchange of that technology which can help you adapt to local climate change, because that will make a country or a state or a district or a community independent or self-reliable in terms of adapting to climate change. So I think we need urgent action in terms of exchange of innovative technology, innovative science, exchange of science and technology or international level. There should not be barriers in that. I think that is quite important, because I know communities which are trying hard. Yeah. So a small community in somewhere in India trying hard to, they're using, instead of paper cups, they use, your reusable ceramic cups. They walk to work or school. That alone will not help in reducing carbon emissions or help in adapting to their local conditions. We need a transformative change, both in adaptation and mitigation. And I'm looking forward to that.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Roxy. It was an education. And is there anywhere else you would like to point listeners so they're able to follow your work, or any organization or your university, or maybe something else?
Well, I talk through different social media handles in Twitter and so on, and I have my own website as well. And I've been trying to disseminate science in whatever possible ways, and I love doing that. And I enjoyed our current discussion as well. It was fun to listen to your stories as well in Australia, how you got affected. So I love to hear people's stories and also how they worked around them. I love working with communities. So there are many best practices from across the world that we can adopt, areas where we are facing similar challenges. So there are bright side of it as well, where we are working together as communities. So even where, when global nations fail, there are communities which are coming up and working collectively with administration, scientists like me, and engineers and schools, educational institutions. Maybe we will close with that story from my home state, which was hit by floods and droughts as well. So now there is a community around the regions of a river called Meenachil River, It's in my home district called Kottayam. And this is a 70 to 80 kilometer long river. And from flowing from the Ghats, from the high ranges to mid range where my home is, and then to the coastal region to the Arabian Sea. And when there are heavy rains upstream, the river swells and, there are floods. But when there are no rains, it's suddenly dry. So due to these climatic changes in this river system and so on, the community started feeling the impacts, like in the Kerala floods. And they thought they should start monitoring these changes. So what they started to do was to install rain gauges in schools all around this area, in the high ranges, mid ranges, and the low ranges downstream as well. And also the river gauges. These are like makeshift just scales drawn on the pillars of the bridges and so on, with different colors showing, okay, low level, mid level, high level of water and so on. And they started recording in their, school books, or they started saying, okay, so in the morning assembly at school, they say, okay, in the last 24 hours, we had this much of rain and so on. So it's a educational collective program with citizens and schools and so on. And in 2018-19, I think, there was one night where there were torrential rains, and they saw that, okay, downstream it's going to flood in 2-3 hours. And there was a colony of family downstream, which was very close to the river. And the volunteers from this team asked those family members to evacuate immediately. But they were not ready to evacuate, because when they looked, the river was kind of dry, right? But we showed the data, and with the help of the administration, they were persuaded to evacuate, and they evacuated soon enough that in 2-3 hours' time, that area was wiped out with the flood water. So the lives of 60 to 70 families were saved in that one night. Many lives would have been lost because it was happening overnight. Yeah. And they didn't have proper housing along the banks of the river. So this is this shows both the challenges of climate change, but also the ways in which we can work together. Yeah. So I would say this is my message. Identify the challenges of your community. Identify the people you can work with. It can be a scientist, it can be a politician, it can be a school or educational institution. Collective action for adaptation and mitigation can work wonders and save lives. Yeah, so that's my message. And I think that's a quite positive message
No, it is. It's an amazing example of an early warning system.
Exactly.
that just works really effectively, yeah. Is low cost and exactly. Understandable for everybody.
Participatory as well. People feel that they are involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Roxy. It was an absolute pleasure to connect and to talk to you and get your thoughts on all this really amazing and important work.
Thanks a lot, Ashley. It means a lot.
If you found this episode of Attributions valuable, please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast channel, follow us on social media, share it with your friends and with your network, and visit our website at www.climateimpactstracker.com for articles and more. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you again on the next episode of Attributions.